You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko skipreiz tōku ingoa, ko te tekau mā rua kāraka, ki te whakaronga koe ki The Wire. Good afternoon and welcome to The Wire for Rātū, Tuesday the 12th of November, whāringa arangi. My name is Oscar Perez and I will be your host today. I am today joined in studio by Rachel. How are you on this relatively greyish day?
Oh, you know. Love.
Yep.
You know?
That is indeed the... sometimes how it goes. C'est la vie, as they say. However, speaking of things that just keep on happening, we again are bringing you, the listener, a full day of news and information with the essence of Tuesday Wire spread throughout. Call it what you want. What are we bringing you, you may ask? That is a relatively good question. Especially considering my general vagueness during the roundup. Ifakane, coming up on the show today, we talk about Owairaka, Mount Albert, its ecological restoration and its cultural importance, as well as the voices currently in the conversation, and discuss the ongoing protests / ecological restoration / replanting of the area. I also talked to Julia Albrecht about the Tiaki Promise and about making a sustainable future for the tourism industry and what the difference between that and greenwashing is. And Rachel, what have you brought for the listeners today?
I talked to registered nurse and youth mental health specialist Dion Howard about an open letter from experts to MPs detailing the facts and evidence regarding a very hot topic right now, assisted dying and also suicide rates.
Indeed. So remember that if you cannot catch these stories throughout the hour, you can catch them by podcast on the 95BFM website under the BCasts subsection. And if you'd like to share your thoughts with us, we'd love to hear them. Toka pātui mai, you can text us on 5395 or wire mai. Give us a call on studio in the studio on 309-3879. Lots of topics, which I'm sure you have a lot to say about as listeners. You can also find us across all of the social medias. That's 95BFM News across all of the Facebook, the Twitter, and the Instagram. Up first, we'll dive into a regular segment for you Tuesday Wire fans.
Kia tau te rangi mari e, o rangi nui e tui honei, o papu tuanuku e takatonei, o te tai ao e awhinei I a tātou, tihei Māori ora.
This is the Green Desk on 95BFM.
Indeed it is, and I will try and fill the gumboots of Mitchell today in speaking on environmental issues. As aforementioned, I spoke to Dr. Julia Albrecht of Otago University about the Tiaki Promise. So they are a lecturer and professor in the kind of tourism management department in Otago, and we decided to talk about the Tiaki Promise, which is a kind of a pledge that tourists will make when coming into Aotearoa around their behaviour in regards to the natural environment as well as its surrounds. So I started by asking her to introduce herself as well as introducing the Tiaki Promise to you, the listener.
My name is Julia Albrecht and I am a senior lecturer and researcher at the University of Otago at the Department of Tourism. And most of my research is on tourism management in the broadest sense, looking at what destinations do in order to manage tourism, but also how communities cope with the tourist influx. And I'm also interested in managing visitors in nature-based tourism especially.
Right. So You have just conducted some new research alongside the kind of social enterprise Good Travel. What was this research about, and what does it show the general population or anyone that reads it about tourism in New Zealand and especially nature tourism?
So my colleague Eliza from, as I say, Good Travel and I were interested in the destination pledges. So many listeners will have heard about the Tiaki Promise, which is largely a social media campaign run by 7 agencies in New Zealand with the aim of creating awareness and ultimately changing visitor behavior in a destination. But we were also interested in how other countries go about this as well. So we talked to stakeholders in Iceland, where the Icelandic pledge was the first one ever. In 2017, we also talked to stakeholders in Hawaii and Palau and Finland. And what does take these very innovative initiatives apart from previous initiatives is the idea of co-creating visitor experiences with the visitors themselves. So we probably all remember how in the past we might have traveled and upon entering, for example, a vulnerable ecologic area, we might have been handed a pamphlet by a guide that says, you shall not do this, you shall not do that. And we know that initiatives like this are not particularly successful because they require the visitor to read and engage with the material and ultimately change their behavior upon instructions that they were giving. And many of us do not respond well to this kind of interaction at the best of times, let alone on holiday. So what the Icelandic Pledge did in 2017 and what Tiaki is also doing extremely well is to get the visitor to commit to changing their behavior. So they don't give instructions. They try to get the visitors on board. They say, look, could you please commit to these sorts of things? For example, I shall drive safely. I shall behave responsibly in the natural environment, things like this. And visitors are asked to commit to these behaviors on social media. So they think about it, they engage, and they commit publicly. And this is very innovative in the tourism industry. That hasn't been done before in that sense. But we know from research in other areas, for example, physical education or other behavioral sciences, that if people commit to a goal publicly, they are much more likely to achieve that goal. So this has been proven, for example, for weight loss goals or fitness goals. And I think it's fascinating to look at and find out whether the same may hold true for responsible behavior in a tourism context. And that's what we did.
Right. So it's essentially creating kind of accountability for yourself and for your own actions via your pledge. Is that kind of correct?
That's essentially the process that participants undergo. And we talk to various stakeholders who set up these pledges. And one of the main motivations was to create awareness for the necessity for changing one's behavior, but also to take people with them and get them on board to committing to changing their behavior. So this is what we're seeing that is happening. And we look forward to follow up future research where we talk to visitors as well to learn about how they perceive these kinds of initiatives and whether they did indeed change their behavior as a result of it.
Right. So you've said that we've seen evidence of this working in other industries, so like weight loss, etc., and exercise. And you've noted that there are pledges elsewhere in the world, notably Iceland. Have we seen any results on that kind of the commitment that tourists have made in, say, like the Icelandic context?
So far, what we've got is anecdotal evidence. So we know, for example, that many tourism operators in the countries where there are pledges use those pledges as a conversation starter with visitors. So where in the past they would have to say, oh, by the way, I need you to behave in this particular way, and people might respond slightly negatively because, as we said, they are on holiday. The pledges make for a much more positive conversation starter because now business operators can say, by the way, have you seen this particular pledge? Have you thought about what it means for our activity today? It might be before visiting a glacier in Iceland, say, or before visiting a vulnerable area in Palau or Hawaii, say. So it's something that we know the tourism operators use. And in terms of the numbers of visitors, it's interesting to note that in Iceland, taking the pledge is voluntary, as it is in New Zealand. But in Palau, interestingly, the pledge is conducted differently. It's not on social media. Upon arrival in Palau, you get a stamp put in your passport, and you are signing this stamp in the presence of a government official. So it's a slightly different approach. It has almost a legal characteristic to it because you are signing your commitment into your most important legal travel document. And because it's part of the immigration procedure, every visitor needs to do it.
Carry on.
No, fine.
I was going to ask, so you noted that in Iceland and Aotearoa, it's a voluntary thing to make this pledge on social media. Was there a reason that when the Tiaki promise or the pledge was set up, it was set up in this way as opposed to the model that is in Palau?
Well, the tourism industry and the visitor numbers in Palau are a lot smaller than in Aotearoa, so it would be a major, major initiative to do it in the same way and get people to have a stamp put in their passport. So I think the logistics are not really comparable simply because of the size of, simply because of the visitor numbers.
Right. Do you think it's something that perhaps the New Zealand tourism industry should look towards, perhaps, once a logistical model is set up for being able to process all these kind of papers?
I think first we would need to look at two things, and that's A, the success of the way Palau is doing it. So we would need to look at whether this way of doing it works in Palau in the coming years. If we see positive outcomes, we might compare with outcomes of the Tiaki promise as it is run now. And I think based on this information, we can then start considering whether a similar model might work in New Zealand. But with the pledges in general, it's still early days, and we need to see to what extent they work and how, and also what particular markets they work for. So if we look at how the pledges are run, mostly social media in Iceland and New Zealand, for example, this is very much targeted towards free independent travelers. This is not something that our group travelers and the coach tour travelers will necessarily take into consideration because they have limited opportunity to select the kinds of activities they engage in during their trip. So at the moment, it's mostly for free independent travelers anyway.
Right. And speaking of areas that it affects, towards the start of the interview, you mentioned that you're particularly concerned in kind of the preservation of natural tourism, etc. Recently in the news across the ditch in Australia, we've seen the closing of Uluru as a kind of tourist destination in terms of being able to climb and walk on it on an ecological level. With the Tiaki promise and the pledges across the world, are they pledges to be exclusively mindful of ecological sites, or will they kind of implement a similar promise to be respectful and mindful of sites of indigenous importance as well, like somewhere like Uluru?
That's an excellent point. And earlier in the interview, when I talked about environmental responsibility, I was merely using that as an example. Even with the Tiaki promise as it exists now, there is a very significant emphasis on indigenous and cultural tourism in New Zealand as well. So New Zealand Maori tourism had very significant input into the preparation and implementation of the pledge, and it's already something that has been considered important throughout the whole process. The same holds true for the Pono Pledge, which is the Hawaiian one. There has also been significant input from indigenous peoples as well. So this is very much comparable to how things have been done in New Zealand. So it is very important already. This is not something that is going to be included in the pledges in the future. That is already happening.
Right, that's a great thing to hear. You've said that there have been, and reading about it, there are several key organizations involved already. How do you judge their commitment to, as to whether it's a purely commercial benefit for them to join in versus a kind of pure commitment to furthering an ecological or restorative message in New Zealand tourism?
Well, the agencies and organizations that were involved in the Te Aki Promise were Tourism New Zealand, Air New Zealand, the Department of Conservation, the Tourism Industry Aotearoa, Industry Representational Body, New Zealand Maori Tourism, Local Government NZ, and Tourism Holdings. So if you just look at this list of organizations, you see that there are government bodies, you see that there's industry representation, but there's also very clearly specific tourism representation as well. So this shows us that there was a deliberate effort to have something that works not only from a business context, not only from a policymaker context, and also something that works across both mainstream and cultural tourism as well. So I think there are business interests simply because it is New Zealand's largest industry, and their business interests need to be represented. But I think the efforts to involve environmental and cultural interests are very much evident, and that is a good thing. And some interviewees in our research have told us that this is probably the broadest participation in any tourism-related initiative or product that they have recently seen.
Wow.
So it was, so everyone in the interviews agreed that this was exemplary in terms of implementing this process in New Zealand tourism.
Certainly. So one last question is, I mean, as you mentioned, it's still in its kind of embryonic phases, but where would you like to see this promise go next, or how do you see this promise being taken into the future?
I think we need to look at how the Te Aki Promise, alongside other pledges, are being taken up by visitors. And we currently see that take-up is not as quick as some might have hoped. So I think next we need to look at how to make these initiatives even more visible. So at the moment we've got the videos on international planes. We've got some visibility at the airport. There's obviously visibility online. But I think we need to find ways to make this even more present in the visitors' minds so that they can make a deliberate decision whether or not to pledge. So I think that's one thing we need to look into. Of course, in a perfect world, you would want the number of visitors who choose to behave responsibly to increase. And eventually, in a perfect world, we wouldn't need the pledges anymore. And responsible travel would become mainstream and just the way tourism is done in New Zealand. But obviously, we are quite a long way from that.
That was the Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Order.
Let's go! Under the Radar and Shoot the Freak in association with 95 BFM presents Shonen Knife live at Whammy Bar, November 14th. Since 81, iconic Japanese secretary supergroup Shonen Knife are bringing rock and roll back to Auckland City. Shonen Knife, Thursday, November 14th at Whammy Bar. Get your tickets now at Under the Radar.
Greece is the time, is the place, is the motion. Greece is playing at MoTat 2 for MoTat Drive-In, November 5th, 16, 7 to 10:30 p.m. Get your tickets now from motat.org.nz. Ooh-hoo-hoo, honey.
Glenn! Ben, what are you doing? You've been in there since 1 o'clock.
Mum, yeah.
What are you... Oh, my God, Glenn, you're completely soaked in gin.
Mum, it's just music.
God, you're dripping eclectic tunes and handpicked vinyl everywhere. God. Do you even know what genres you've been trying?
Mum, it's genre-free.
Sweet Jesus, come on, into the shower. Yeah. You're sweating music everywhere.
The Tuesday 1 to 4 Show with Gin. 3 hours of genre-free musical exploration for your Tuesday afternoon. Right here on 95BFM. Sit back, open your ears, and let it all soak in.
Indeed. Kosk Pereza Ho, if Fakaronga Anakwe, Kitawaya Marunga 95BFM. Fakapamai, if you want to share your thoughts with us, Tukabatuimai, you can text us on Rima Toru Iwa Rima, that's 5395, or Wayamai, give us a call on studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa, that's 309-3879. Jin will, of course, be on after The Wire. But up next on The Wire, we have a piece by Rachel. So, do you want to give us a bit of a background onto your little talk?
Yeah, sure. So, it's often said that the debate around euthanasia is not black and white, but rather grey. Last week, a group of 21 mental health experts signed an open letter to MPs detailing the facts and evidence regarding assisted dying and suicide rates. I usually think about the 1973 sci-fi film Soylent Green when talking about euthanasia. In an overpopulated post-apocalyptic world where there's no longer enough resources to sustain people, if you'd like to die, you can just go to a hospital, they ask your favorite music, and they peacefully allow you to die. And the essential question is there a right to die? Or maybe even sometimes a duty? I talked to Dion Howard, who is a registered nurse and specialist youth mental health worker. We discussed the experience of professionals who see these issues firsthand. Please be advised that this interview might contain some sensitive material. I started by asking him to explain what the open letter says.
So the letter is signed by 20 people who are sort of leading academics or practitioners in medicine and mental health and research. And really what it's saying is that the idea that there can be no risk around our current suicide rates because of the introduction of euthanasia is not founded on any solid evidence. So really there's a whole lot of uncertainty as to what might be the impact of euthanasia, new euthanasia legislation, if it's introduced, what might be the impact on suicide rates.
And so what kinds of people have signed the letter?
So, I've signed the letter, but I'm a registered nurse working at adolescent mental health. So I do therapy with people who are chronically suicidal and or deliberately self-harming. That's my area of specialty. But most of the other people, for instance, Kirsty Loudon, who works in the area of suicide prevention, professors of CBT at Otago University, just giving you a sample of some of the people, Dr. Richard Linscott, who's a senior lecturer in psychology at Otago, John Adams is a psychiatrist. So a lot of psychiatrists in there, so people with a strong hand in mental health and a couple of people working in elderly medicine as well.
So what do you think attracts people in these professions to the cause?
Do you mean to this particular cause, like to sign this
letter? Yeah. So why are these academics and psychiatrists, why are these types of people interested in?
Why are they interested? Well, I guess they are interested in public policy being shaped by evidence, and they have a concern that there's been a real lack of evidence. The efforts going towards legalising euthanasia have in some part been advanced by the idea that it's safe. And what's attracted these people is that they would say, and the letter says, that there is little to no evidence to kind of confirm that it would be safe. In fact, there's very few studies into the area. It is such a new emerging field internationally. There's been really one study, and one of those studies is frequently cited by David Seymour, for instance, and proponents as kind of outlined that it is evidence of its safety, when in fact the study, which is an Oregon study from 2015, really just says that there's been no decrease in suicides, which is interesting because one of the claims has been that the introduction of euthanasia will lead to a decrease in suicides. And that study has been cited widely, and the feeling of the letter writers is that it's been misrepresented as well.
Okay. So could you elaborate on what's meant by the direct or indirect causal relationship between assisted dying and assisted suicides? How are they connected? Each other, yeah. So assisted dying and assisted suicides, how do they relate?
How do they relate to each other? Well, I mean, I guess both of them involve an act of will to decide to end one's life. Frequently, and I think the idea has been sort of proposed that they have nothing to do with suicide, and I would suppose in many senses that's true. You know, the act doesn't propose for people to commit suicide for, or for no good reason, or to make a willful act, whether with the assistance of someone else or not, to end their life. So in many ways, suicide and assisted suicide and euthanasia are not the same, but in some ways they are also the same. And the question is, we don't really understand in which way that they are the same. And my interest really began when I started talking to young people who started to employ the justifications around end of life with regards to their own sense of hopelessness and wanting to end their own lives. And so they were utilising the arguments of bodily autonomy, and unbearable suffering. And I found that really interesting. Of course, the proposed legislation doesn't qualify them to do that. But what's important to understand is whether or not it would have an unintended impact. And really, there's no strong evidence to say that it wouldn't have an unintended impact. So we are really urging our MPs to consider this and consider whether or not should we be more certain about the impact on our suicide rates before we pass this legislation.
I think that's very true. Like the national sentiment that there's a right to die, or maybe even sometimes a duty, that will actually affect other people. But can we equate young people dying because they feel they have no autonomy and no choice? Is it the same as people on their sickbed choosing to die?
Well, I guess that's a good question and it needs to be answered. And that's really what the letter is about. Can we equate it? And I would say in my practice, I began to see some alarming situations where people were equating it. Now, it's not reasonable to equate it. It's not sensible to equate it. But that doesn't actually matter. What matters is, will it be equated? And will that change the impact? And what we do know, for instance, in the Netherlands, that there has been a slow and steady increase in suicides, while the surrounding countries have had quite a rapid decline in suicide. And we don't know why that is, but what we can't do is discount or dismiss a euthanasia-enabling environment as to be an active factor in that process. Yeah, so it's not really even so much to do with the ethics of it, but rather to do with the impact and the potential unintended consequences.
There's a lot of discussion about, like, David Seymour's whole thing is, like, you know, the right to choose, the right to be free.
Sure.
And
yep.
Do you think a personal right to choose sometimes actively harms or doesn't meet the needs for society as a whole? Do you think that's the kind of ethos of the letter?
I don't think that's the ethos of the letter. I think that, that's a question about personal morality. I think the ethos of the letter is, can we be certain that this will be safe and not have an impact? And really they're advancing the idea that there is very little certainty. And in fact, the legislation has been advanced with lots of assurance that there is certainty, and there is actually no certainty. There is a lack of evidence to say that it is safe. So the question around whether the right to choose can have harm society or not, I guess we get to choose that as a democratic and parliamentary process. We get to kind of make that decision. But in order to make a decision, we should have all the facts on the table. And one of those facts perhaps should be some better understanding and research as to whether or not this would have an effect. And we do have the potential, with, for instance, in Canada, who have, you know, just enacted very similar legislation to what we're proposing, to actually wait and see if it does have an impact. But what we, instead, what we tend to have is David Seymour and proponents dismissing the concerns, and I think they've done a reasonably successful job. But, you know, David Seymour, he's an advocate, not a researcher, and they've successfully dismissed concerns. And we're really just saying, you know, shouldn't we be certain? Are we certain? No. Should we be certain? Yes, we should.
So could you speak a little on the precautionary principle that's mentioned in the letter?
Sure. Well, I guess in kind of in lay people's terms, the precautionary principle is simply that if there is doubt that something may trigger or lead to a greater harm, we should not proceed or proceed with caution. And, you know, I mean, we it's a principle that we would sort of reflexively operate in every day in our lives. You know, if we perceive a danger, we will pause, scan the environment, gather evidence, is it safe to go on? And simply in this situation, we need to, utilising that precautionary principle, we would say we need to stop, scan the environment, what's happening in Canada, how do we understand what's happened in the Netherlands, do we have actual evidence, not advocacy, but rather, you know, some robust evidence, and then proceed if it's safe.
So do you think it matters that our demographic for suicide is predominantly, you know, young, usually teenage, Māori, like males, like those are the demographics. Do you think it matters that that's different to the European and Canadian studies?
Well, it does. I mean, we can't necessarily draw, I mean, frequently we've been advised to draw from the other countries as evidence that it's safe, but we have a unique environment. So really there perhaps should also be, you know, some research in our context, although for obvious reasons, a very difficult thing to research. So, you know, one level of research is to look at other examples, and we need to do that. And what would be, how would we compare and contrast those examples to our context? So, you know, and in New Zealand, we're in a particular situation where the death by suicide rate is particularly high around young Māori. And what does that mean? You know, and the people that are advancing the legislation are not young Māori. You know, they tend to be predominantly Pākehā and older and affluent people advocating for this change. So in some sense, we need to be very mindful of our context and consider who would be the most impacted by any unintended consequences of this legislation.
So where do you think the line needs to be drawn? Like, what changes will we have to make to the bill for your group to support euthanasia?
Well, I guess, I think everyone would have a different, every letter signer or signatory to the letter would have a different position
yeah,
on
course,
that.
Yeah.
My personal view is that the end-of-life choice bill is not safe until we've made those, until we have those assurances. Now, I speak as a clinician working with suicidal young people. You know, I don't think that the bill is safe until we have that evidence that it is safe, and then I think we go back to the drawing board.
So why do you think New Zealanders are so divided on the issue, and how do you think the referendum will go?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you're speaking about the referendum as if it's a fait accompli, and certainly there is that sense, you know, as the third reading this week.
Right, it might not even happen. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it may not, but, you know, I think one reason why we seem divided is the way, you know, I've not seen a piece of legislation that kind of promises or overstates the benefits so much. And I think partly that's to do with people have so little experience of dying, or other people dying, rather, I guess, to be more accurate. People are frightened of that process and the pain and the discomfort, you know, but I think the proponents have made a very effective job of capturing the narrative around that. Yet the experts in the field, you know, palliative care experts, they certainly tell another story. So, yeah, I wonder if we're so divided because it sort of keys in with other sort of issues around freedom and political identity and this kind of right to not be told what to do, it seems to be. But I would suspect that if we had all the facts in front of us, we would not be so divided and we'd find that actually much more grey than we realise.
That's what I think. It's a really grey issue. Even I find it really complex, and I was really nervous to do this interview because I'm really on the fence.
Sure. Well, look, look, I started doing some work in this area, and you know, I made a submission to the Health Select Committee at the last round as well because of my experience.
Yeah.
And I made a submission to the Select Committee. And in that process, my own father died of cancer and had kind of like around an 18-month period of illness, I guess, as he was living the last part of his life. So I was very frightened that I, you know, would be very challenged in my point of view by that experience.
Yeah.
And we all sense that because actually that's something that happens to everyone as everyone dies. And we want to have a good death. And indeed, probably we would prefer, we don't want to see our loved ones suffering, and we want them to have a good death as well. And, you know, I think it is complex because we have a lot of those feelings that we don't necessarily want to sort of confront or face around that.
Yeah.
And I would have to say that in my father's death, and that's only one, you know, situation, and this debate has been very much coloured by people's individual stories, but we must remember that we're making public policy.
Yeah.
But I must say that my father's death was, how do I put it, like an incredible experience with the support and care of hospice. It was not an easy experience, but I don't think any good experience is easy. And, yeah, it was not what I expected it to be. Let's just kind of say that. So, you know, I think people are... It's complex and people are divided because it's to do with something that we're all quite frightened of. And
yeah,
I don't
exactly,
think we're necessarily frightened of death, but of dying. And we're very sheltered from it in our society now.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.